Thank you very much. It's really a great pleasure and honor for me to address you here in this unusual, outstanding gathering of Torah. Ken Yerbu, and I understand that it's growing each year even more and more, and it should go that way from now on. I just want to start a little bit with some humor. Three people meet at a friend's funeral. One says, I can't read it from so far, one says, at my funeral, I wish people will recall my good deeds and at work. The second one says, I wish that people will talk about my good nature. The third one says, I wish people will say, oh, he is moving. So sometimes people don't want to die, even at the last moment. We're talking about issues in end of life, and sometimes people hold to life even the last minute. But there's the other side of the coin. The physician says to the wife of the patient, I'm sorry to tell you that your husband is very ill and he probably will die within a few days. So she says, well, I waited so long, I'll wait another few days. So there are these two sides of the approach on the dying patient. And I'll try to present to you a few aspects of how halacha deals with the situation of dying people, which is in many ways very, very different than the secular way of dealing with a dying patient, and in particularly the way the secular world in the United States is dealing with dying patients. So, to begin with, the dilemma that we are facing when a patient is dying seems to be a medical question. He has a disease and a physician is taking care of him. But if you come to think about it, it's almost non-medically related when decisions have to be made for a dying patient. Because any intervention that medicine can offer, and nowadays medicine can do a lot to prolong life, whether or not to apply the particular technique in a particular mode of treatment is not a medical decision. The physician as such has no more responsibility and no more moral obligation than anyone else, because the questions related to whether or not to treat a dying patient are basically questions that relate to culture, to law, to philosophy, to ethics, and from our perspectives, for halacha. So you can put a patient on a respirator, and you cannot put him on a respirator. So what a physician can offer is say, if you put him on a respirator, A and B will happen. If you don't put him on a respirator, C and D will happen. But whether or not to put him on a respirator is, in most instances, in dying patients, not a medical, a pure medical decision, but rather a cultural and, from our perspective, a halachic question. So if we look what's happening today in the world on end-of-life decisions, we can see a slippery slope, from my perspective, from a situation that everyone agreed that you are not allowed to hasten a death of anyone, no matter how short term his life is expected to be. Yet, we find in countries which are Western and certainly have good ethics and they have good intentions, that killing a patient who is dying is legally allowed. It started in Holland, it continued in Belgium, now it's in Canada, what is called active euthanasia, which means that if a patient is dying, although he can live another 5-6 months, he wants to die right now, but from his illness, he's not going to die right now, it is permissible that he can ask the physician to inject a lethal dose and kill him. And that is it's called euthanasia. It's not called killing, but really a euphemism to say that I am killing you because this is what you wish to happen to you now. So there are quite a few countries that already legalized it. In Belgium, it affects not only adults who can consent and request it, but it also affects children and infants. So that if the parents feel that the infant or the child is going to die and they don't want him to continue to live until the day death will come in the natural way, it is permissible to kill the infant or the child on the parents' request. So that is one level of decision-making in certain countries. Another level of decision-making is what's called physician-assisted suicide, which is one step below the active euthanasia. The physician is not allowed himself to inject the lethal dose and kill the patient, but he is allowed to prescribe a medication that is lethal, and the patient will take it himself. So it's assisted suicide in a way, but it doesn't sound nice, so they give it different names in different countries where this is permissible, that actually the patient can commit suicide with the help of the physician. That started in Oregon. By now, I think there are 5 states in the United States that legalized it, and there are many debates in other states, and perhaps that will come there as well. And one step further from that, no active killing or by the patient or by the physician, but doing acts that hasten death, which is called withdrawal of treatment. So that if someone is already on a form of treatment that sustains his life and he doesn't want to continue to live, it is permissible to withdraw the measurement that keeps him alive, whereby he will die. The combination of all these mechanisms for end of life is that someone is doing an act that hastens death. And that halachically is not permissible. So all these methods of hastening death, whether it is active euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide or withdrawal of a method that by stopping it, you kill the patient, those all are not permissible. Not only that, and we'll go into some of the sources in a few minutes, in the United States, in some European countries as well, even if active act that hastens death is not permitted, and I may add not yet permitted, because the trend is that it's going this direction, it is permitted to stop any form of sustaining life. They call it a form of treatment, but it's not always a treatment. For instance, it's permissible to stop food and fluid and let the patient die of hunger or dehydration, although of his disease, he will die much later. So food and fluid is regarded as a form of treatment by many countries, many Western countries, and hence you're allowed to withdraw it and let the patient die of it. So all these are halachically not permissible. I want to go through a few examples of how halacha treats end-of-life issues based on the Israeli law. There was a legislation in 2005 that I had the privilege to chair a national committee that proposed the legislation, and it is based primarily on the shittas of Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. Not all the poskim agree with each detail in the law, but in general, according to those two poskim, the law is affirmed by their position. It was a big fight to legislate it in Israel. You know, Israel is a Jewish state, but actually it's a secular state. And if you come to the Knesset and you say, halacha says so-and-so, it's a priori no good. even if they agree with it, but if it's halacha, it's no good. So we had to word it in different words, ethical concerns and legal concerns, so that the actual law will be according to at least the major poskim I mentioned, without saying that this is halacha. But I'll show you how the wording in the law is actually based on those positions. So it was a large committee, 59 members. You can imagine three Jews speaking about the weather. You get usually around six opinions, and here there are 59 of them, and they don't speak about the weather. They speak about end of life, which is a very complex issue. So you can imagine the debates that went on. But finally, the law was enacted, and now it is the law in Israel. So let's start with the definition of a dying patient. The English term currently used is a terminal patient. But if you come to think about it, it's a misnomer. Because if you say that this patient is terminal, it means that we who are not in this stage are immortal, right? Because he is terminal, so what are we? So we all are terminal. So to say about a patient that is terminal, we actually didn't say anything. We just said that no one is immortal. But that doesn't define who the dying patient is. So we don't call them in Hebrew a terminal patient. The translation is sofani. But we call them a dying patient who is different than someone who is not yet dying. But what defines a dying patient? So the definition is based on a distinction that according to halacha, there is a concept that it's called chayei sha'ah, which is distinguished from chayei olam. And again, chayei sha'ah doesn't mean a life of 1 hour, and chayei olam doesn't mean a life forever, because neither of those represent what we talk about. So chayei sha'ah means a temporary life, something that will end soon, and chayei olam is longer than chayei sha'ah. Anything longer than chayei sha'ah becomes a chayei olam. And there are sugyos and shas discussing the issues of chayei sha'ah, and the sugyos are in related to the arba metzoroim that we just read, the haftorah, last Shabbos, and the Arba Metzorim were Gehazi and his three sons, and the story is in Tanakh that they were Metzoraim, they were what is called lepers, although probably Metzora is not a leper, but just for the convenience of the discussion, and a Metzora is sent out of the city. He can't dwell in the city. So they were outside the walls of Jerusalem, and there was a war between Ashur and the people inside the wall. And they felt that if that they had to make a choice. If they'll stay outside the wall, they'll die of hunger. No one will come visit them because the wall is enclosed by the Ashurim. If they'll go into the city, despite the fact that they are not allowed halachically, but it's pikuach nefesh, they need to eat, but they will be killed by the enemy. So they decided to go to the Ashurim and take their chance. Either they'll kill them or they'll take them captives and they'll stay alive. And the Gemara discusses whether it was right or not right for their decision to hasten death for the chance to lengthen life. So they had a chayei sha'ah at the stage that they were at. They'll die of hunger soon. But they took a chance that they might live longer if the Ashurim will not kill them. Rav Moshe Feinstein has an interesting take on it, that who were the four Metzorayim? We said Gehazi and his three sons. According to Chazal, they were Reshoim. They were such Reshoim that they didn't have a chelek lo'olam habo. So how do you learn a haloche from such people? And the answer is that we don't learn any halachas. We learn what is normally done by people. And their choice was a normal act that people would do in a situation where they have a chance to live longer, but they may sacrifice the short life that they have. So that is the fact that is learned from this story, and the Gemara in Avodah Zarah discusses the parameters, what is permissible to do in Chayei Sha'ah that is not permissible to do in Chayei Olam. However, saying Chayei Sha'ah doesn't really help us to make practical decisions, because what is Chayei Sha'ah? How long is Chayei Sha'ah compared to Chayei Olam? We need parameters. So most poskim, without going too much into the history of the definitions, but both Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, Moshe Feinstein, and many of the poskim who dealt with this issue, defined Chayei Sha'ah as someone who can live up to 12 months, similar to the definition of Treifa. Treifa is defined as an animal that with this blemish that he has, can't live more than 12 months. So the definition of a dying patient by halachic criteria would be equivalent to the definition of a Chayei Sha'ah, and a Chayei Sha'ah is defined as up to 12 months. However, if we look from a practical point of view, from a medical point of view, there's almost never a statistical proof that a patient at this stage in life will live up to 12 months. The statistical error in that would be like a guess. So no one can predict really 12 months. And hence, many countries have adopted a more stricter definition, and that is what we adopted in the Israeli law, and we define a Chayei Sha'ah, or a dying patient, as someone who has a lethal disease that cannot be cured, and the stage of the disease that he is in now is such that he will die within 6 months. Now, 6 months, A, can be predicted in certain diseases and certain circumstances, statistically, and B, if we err in the assessment, and instead of 6 months, he lived 8 months, or 9 months, or 10 months, he is still within the parameter of Chayei Sha'ah by the halachic criteria, because he can be within this parameter until 12 months. Whereas if we would have said that up to 12 months we can apply the laws of Chayei Sha'ah, as we will see in a minute, if we erred and he lived 13 months, then we violated halacha. We were not allowed to take this action based on the fact that he is Chayei Sha'ah, because we erred and he is Chayei Olam. So therefore, the decision was 6 months. Most of the poskim that I consulted on that agreed with this definition, except for Avil Yashiv, who did not accept the definition of 12 months to begin with, and not even of 6 months. He told me that for him, a Chayei Sha'ah is closer to 3 months, not beyond that. And when I asked him, what is the source for it? Where do we find 3 months as a definition of Chayei Sha'ah? I didn't get an answer. So I don't know what his source was, but that was his position. But most of the poskim who hold 12 months certainly will agree to 6 months, and 6 months is a time that we can define. So that is a definition of a dying patient. A dying patient is someone who has a lethal disease that he is going to die from the disease no matter what, but he is already at the stage that he is expected statistically to die within 6 months. That is the definition of a dying patient. Now, what can we do or not do for someone who is a dying patient, or a Chayei Sha'ah, as opposed to someone who is Chayei Olam? So that would depend on what value we give to life and to autonomy. So there is a minority of opinion that holds that the value of life is of infinite value. And if the life is of infinite value, then no matter how much or how little the person is going to live, every minute is a whole lifetime. Because how can you say that 1 minute doesn't count, and then we'll ask you, what about 1 hour? What about 1 day? What about 1 week? Where do you draw the line? And since we don't know how to draw the line, we assume that every minute of life is of value, and hence we should do everything possible to prolong whatever we can prolong. If we would have accepted this position, then the law would be a one-sentence law. Every patient, no matter what he wants, no matter how much he's suffering, no matter how short his lifespan is expected, do everything possible to prolong whatever you can prolong. That would be the law. This, however, is a minority position, and the majority position holds that life is maybe the most important value, but not of infinite value. And this also, even the value of life has boundaries, has limitations. And it seems like it's very difficult not to accept this position, because there are quite a few sources that show that indeed we don't do everything for everyone to prolong every minute of life. So one example is war. According to Halacha, there is milchemet mitzvah, there's milchemet chova, but even milchemet reshut. If we would say that the value of life is of infinite value, everyone who is drafted to a war will come out with a little tzettel and say, I can't go to war because my life is of infinite value, and in a war I may be killed, so I won't go to war. And how did the Torah allow to do wars? Capital punishment for Chilul Shabbos, for any other of the Isurim that someone is doing, shows that there are values that are greater than the value of life. And if someone desecrated Shabbat, his life is less of a value than keeping Shabbat. And there are many such instances whereby we see that the value of life is limited in extreme situations. But coming to our case, discussing our situation, there is a famous source in the end of Gemara Ksubos describing the last days of Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi. Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi had a disease called Tzamirta. We don't know exactly what it is. Some say there were gallstones or kidney stones. He had a disease which caused him a lot of pain. And the Talmidim were praying that his life should continue. And the Talmidim's prayer was like a respirator, was like a dialysis machine. The prayer worked, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi continued to live. Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi had a maid, a female maid, that was a very smart woman, and the Gemara tells about the Talmidim who used to ask her questions in Halacha. In newer periods of time, we would say she was the Shikse Bamruf, someone who served the rabbi all the time, knew many things that the Talmidim who came occasionally didn't know. So she felt it is wrong to prolong his life because he's suffering. But who is she compared to the Talmidim? So the Gemara tells us that she went up on the roof and she threw down a jar that broke and it made a lot of noise. And the Talmidim got frightened from the noise for a minute, and they stopped praying, and then Malach HaMavet was able to penetrate, and Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi died. Now, if we'll translate it to what we are discussing, so the Talmidim held that the value of life is of infinite value. So who cares that Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi is suffering? Who cares that he's going to die anyway? We have to pray for him to live as much as we can help him to live. Whereas the maid said that there is a limit to how much we have to prolong a life of suffering when anyway the person is going to die, and we should let him die. We shouldn't, chas v'sholom, hasten his death or do an act that kills him, but we don't have to do something proactive to prolong his life. So that's the machloikes. When there's a machloikes, we need a psak. So interestingly, the Ran in Nedorim, not related to the sugya in Ksubos, The Ran and the Dorim paskens like Amsei the Rebbe. He says halacha is like the servant, that if a patient is suffering, not only don't you have to pray for prolonging his life, but actually he says you should pray to shorten his life. I never encountered a shul where someone is doing a mesheberach to a choile to die, but according to the Ran, that is what you should do. Because if he is suffering and he is anyway dying, so the best for him is really to die. HaKadosh Baruch Hu will do it, not we. But he says you should pray for it. I won't go into the subtle halachas issues when and who can pray for a person to die, but certainly you don't have to pray for him to continue his life. That has been extended by the poskim, not only to prayer, but to actual acts that we are allowed to withhold and let the patient die. Of sources that point to the fact that if a patient is dying and suffering, you are allowed to withhold treatments that will prolong his life, which is temporary, chayei sha'a, full of suffering, and hence you don't need to do it. And that all the sources that are here and some in your handout, you can find that that the poskim discussed it that way. Interestingly, Moshe Feinstein went one step further, and he said, not only don't we have to treat a patient who is dying and suffering to prolong his life, but actually we are forbidden to do it. We are forbidden to treat a patient who is suffering and dying because we are forbidden to add suffering in vain. That was Moshe Feinstein's position, as you can see here on the screen. Rabbi Zalman Auerbach told me that he thinks that was a little going too far, to say that there is an issue to prolong life, that he didn't agree, but he certainly agreed that there is no chiyuv to prolong such a life, and you are allowed to withhold certain treatments and let the patient die. So that is the principle. Now, the issue is, how do we do it in practice? What can we do, what can't we do in a situation of a dying patient? So, from a secular point of view, there are all kinds of definitions. What constitutes a quality of life low enough that a person can ask not to be living anymore in this situation? From a halachic point of view, most of these definitions are unacceptable. It is not the cognitive phase of the patient. He may be smart enough to come to this lecture and maybe understand or not, or listen or not. That is not a quality that if he can't do it, then let him die, right? So cognitive function is not a criterion for a person not to continue to live. Social aspects, economic aspects, all these are not factors to let a patient die. The only quality of life situation that halacha accepts to withhold treatment is pain and suffering. If a patient is dying, and again, it's only in a dying patient, if a patient is dying and he is suffering, certainly if he asks not to prolong his suffering, but even if he doesn't ask, but he didn't say on the contrary, and we assume that a person doesn't want to suffer in end-of-life conditions, then we are allowed to withhold certain treatments, which we'll discuss in a minute. So that is how we assess a quality of life. Now, when we talk about pain and suffering, how do we define that? How much weight of kilograms, of ounces of suffering is okay to let the patient die? Can we assess the amount of suffering, the amount of pain that is enough of a reason to let a patient die? So here there is a dispute between Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and Rav Eliashiv. According to Rav Eliashiv, you have to see, it has to be visible that the dying patient is indeed suffering. But if, for instance, he is comatose and we don't see on him any signs of pain and suffering, then you should continue treating him with all treatments no matter what, which creates sometimes an unclear situation, because before he became comatose, when he was still aware, he was suffering terribly. And at that stage, according to Abel Yashiv, you would be allowed to withhold the treatment. But if you didn't withhold the treatment and he continued to deteriorate and he became comatose, now you're obligated to treat him, which in a way is a little bit difficult to understand. Whereas, according to Rav Auerbach, every dying patient, by definition, is suffering. Suffering is not necessarily pain. He can suffer from the fact that existentially he is going to die. That is one of the major causes of suffering, and that is sufficient, according to Rav Auerbach, to regard him as a dying, suffering patient, and then apply what is permissible to apply. So let me just summarize. I see the time is coming up. How do we know what a patient wants? So if at the stage that he is dying, he is still competent, so he can express himself. He can say, I don't want any more further treatments, and whatever is permissible halachically not to give him, we'll do, and whatever not, we won't listen to him. But unfortunately, most dying patients are at such a stage that they are not any more competent. They are either comatose or depressed or under anesthesia or under treatments and medications, and they can't say now what they want. So one way to know what they want is for us now, hopefully all of us are healthy and competent, to express our wishes on what we would want once we will become dying and incompetent. That is called advanced medical directives, and we can do such an advanced directive or appoint a surrogate that we talk to him and he knows what we would have wished in this situation, and that is acceptable by law and by halacha as well, provided what it is asked is within the permission of halacha to do or not to do. And here is how we look at the situation. First of all, palliative care. Palliative care means treatment for removing or reducing the amount of pain and suffering. Now, in the old days, when this field in medicine was not well developed and they knew to use only morphine and they didn't know exactly how to do it, many physicians are not trained in how to do it. In many instances, giving morphine for the purpose of reducing pain caused hastening of death, because it affects the respiratory center and the patient stops breathing. Nowadays, palliative care is very advanced. There are many ways how to treat pain and suffering, and there is no reason to do it in such a way that it will hasten death. Nevertheless, occasionally, a patient that gets this treatment may hasten his death. Would it be permissible? So Rav Auerbach explained it in the following way. If someone has a brain tumor, what do you do for him to save his life? You take him to the OR, to the operating room, you do the operation in order to save his life. But 5% die on the table. Would we say that because there is a certain percentage dying of the treatment that is necessary, because without the treatment 100% will die, we shouldn't do it because a certain percent dies? That is not how medicine operates. Every complicated treatment has side effects, including mortality. That doesn't exclude the treatment from being legitimate. Rav Auerbach said that a dying patient has a new illness. His illness is pain. That's only the only factor that counts for his existence, because we can't treat him on his basic disease, otherwise he wouldn't be a dying patient. So the pain is equivalent to the brain tumor, and the morphine is equivalent to the operation. And the same way that we are obligated to operate in order to save the life, although there are certain percentages of mortality, the same holds true for treating pain and suffering, provided you do it professionally and the numbers are low. And indeed, they are very low if it is done correctly. And moreover, certain patients, the treatment for their pain even prolongs their life, because pain produces certain chemicals that can shorten life. And if we take care of the pain, these chemicals are not produced and the patient can live longer. So that certainly palliative care is accepted halachically by all poskim. Let me conclude with the considerations on treatment. And as you can see here in this slide, two columns. The green one is a column of treatments that pertain to the dying situation. A person who is not dying, who is not sick, who doesn't have a severe illness, doesn't need all these treatments. We don't need a respirator, we don't need a dialysis machine, we don't need chemotherapy, we don't need radiotherapy, we don't need surgeries. All these pertain to the fact that he has a disease, and we know by definition that it's not treatable except for prolonging a little bit the life, and then we give the green treatments. On the other hand, the column, the blue column, is something that every person, whether he's dying or not dying, is in need of. We all need food, we all need fluids, we sometimes get an infection and we need antibiotics for treatment, and so on. These are treatments that don't pertain to the fact that he's a dying patient. So halachically, one is permitted to withhold the treatments that are on the green column because we have decided that he has only chayeshor by definition, and he is suffering by definition, and we are not obligated to prolong his life by interventions that are related to the fact that he is dying. But even a dying patient needs food and fluid, because the reason for him to die is the cancer or the kidney disease or the heart disease, but to kill him by hunger or by dehydration is irrelevant. Why should he die of something that is irrelevant to the fact that he is dying? So we are not allowed, even in a dying patient, to withhold the blue treatments, but we are allowed to withhold the green ones. Now, Reb Shlomo Zalman made a distinction within the green treatments. And the distinction is as follows. He distinguished between a continuous form of treatment and an intermittent or a cyclic form of treatment. So let's take, for example, the treatment of dialysis. How do you treat normally a patient who is not dying, a patient who has kidney failure and he needs a dialysis treatment? You call him in on Sunday, you hook him up to the dialysis machine for 4 hours, you take him off the machine, he goes home, he comes on Tuesday for another round. From a halachic point of view, each unit of treatment is a new decision. So that if we decided to give him a chance and to start dialysis, and we see that he's suffering and anyway dying, and that just prolongs his life and suffering, you're allowed to withhold the next unit of treatment. And that will not be called withdrawing halachically, it will be called withholding halachically. And if you think about it, most treatments are of this nature. Chemotherapy, you give him today, you give him another dose in a day or in a week or in 10 days, and every time you give a new unit of the treatment, of the chemotherapy, of the radiotherapy. two types of treatments that sustain life are not of this nature. One is a respirator, and another one is a pacemaker. You can't take a patient who is on a respirator and is on demand for the respirator and put him Sunday morning for 4 hours on the respirator, take him off, and tell him to come to you on Tuesday. He'll never come, right? Because he will die. That is not a cyclic treatment. That's a continuous treatment. So if we withdraw this treatment, we're actually killing him because he needs this treatment continuously. And the same is true for a pacemaker. So treatments like dialysis, chemotherapy, and so on, if we started them, we still have an option to withhold the further units of treatment. Whereas a respirator or a pacemaker, once we started it, we cannot withdraw it because that would be a form of killing. And I'll finish with another chiddush of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach concerning the respirator. And I'll tell you a story when it happened and how. One of the presidents of Israel was Yitzhak Navon. His wife had breast cancer, metastatic breast cancer. She suffered terribly. She was in an ICU in Yerushalayim. And they treated her very aggressively. The wife of the president, everyone felt that you have to treat her the best you can. And she wouldn't die. But she suffered terribly. So the president told the physicians he doesn't want his wife to suffer, but he doesn't want to violate halacha. He wants to do something that halachically will be permissible. So I went to Shlomo Zalman Auerbach and I described him the situation. And his psak was the following. You are allowed to reduce the parameters of the respirator, reduce the amount of oxygen, reduce the amount of pressure that you have to put into the machine, and lower it to a degree that a healthy person needs it. So we, for instance, need 21% of oxygen. We don't need 100% of oxygen. So this patient doesn't need 100% of oxygen. Once you reduce it, when the patient worsens and he needs more of it, then you are not obligated to intervene. It's just another form of withholding without withdrawing the respirator. The respirator is still functioning, but on a lower level. That was done, and after 24 hours, Mrs. Navon passed away. I came to Shlomo Zalman and I said, could I please publish this psak because it's very useful in many situations where people were put on a respirator because that's the initial treatment that you give to anyone who comes to the ER. You don't know what the situation is at the moment, but then you see that actually if you would know ahead of time, you wouldn't put him on a respirator, but now you can't stop it. That is a way to help the patient in this situation. So he said, if you come with another case like this, I'll say the same, but I don't want it to be published because I don't know if other poskim will agree with me. It's a serious decision, so it's not to be published. So I asked him, what will take that you should agree to publish it? So he said, if other poskim will agree, I'll consider it. So I went to Rav Vozner, and I described to him what Shlomo Zalman said, and he said, I agree absolutely with what he said, except for one disagreement. And this is not to reduce the parameters at once. Because if you at once take the patient from 100% oxygen to 21%, it's as if you stop the respirator. So what you should do is reduce to 90, wait a little, see how he takes it. If he's okay, reduce further, and stop at a level where he can't take it anymore. And then if he becomes worse, you don't have to increase it back. So I came back to Shlomo Zalman and I told him that I spoke with Rav Vozner. He was very happy because he regarded Rav Vozner as a big poisek. And he asked, so what did he say? And I told him. He said, you see, it was good that you didn't publish because he's right. If you would have published the way I said it, that would be wrong. And I agree with him. So I said, okay, so now can I publish? He said, yes, publish in his name. But finally, he agreed that it will be published by both names, and that is now the way we treat respiratory-dependent patients at Shaare Tzedek. Thank you very much.